Okay. Ja. Okay. Morning, quarter past ten. We start. How are you guys?
Great.
Good. Yes, welcome to the second week, second lecture. Before we dig into the first subject, to a kind of practical information, the first one is related to the textbook. I had a discussion with a couple of students at the end of the last lecture last week about whether it is kind of compulsory to purchase this dedicated textbook. And I tried to be kind of diplomatic in answering the question. I mean, I'm not able to force you guys to buy this book. And to some extent, this is not necessary either. But my point is, then it is your responsibility to find a kind of appropriate alternative content to our lectures, which kind of matches the content of the textbook. Yes? Okay, excellent. Yes, okay. Many thanks. If that is kind of a legal agreement, so then that's absolutely fine. No, otherwise, my point in general is, as we discussed previously, so You're encouraged kind of to dig into the different subjects on your individual interest and to find out what is relevant. I mean, we're going to point out some relevant issues during the lecture. But then it's just a kind of grasping on the surface. So then it is your responsibility then to dig into the more details. And whether you get the details from this textbook or from another textbook, that is then basically up to you. So the exam question is not related to a certain chapter or to a certain page or paragraph in the textbook. It is a kind of getting a clear understanding about the subject as such. Okay, having said that, then okay, some power. Okay. The second point is related to the course work. So I introduced the first coursework last week. Probably what I was not that clear about is where to sign up for the groups. There is a link to this spreadsheet, and that is the area where I would like you to sign up. First within a group, and then the group is discussing the topic, the four topics we introduced last week, and then you sign up on that sheet. And I also added the corresponding lab sessions where we're going to address Newton's prism attempt. We're going to address additive subtractive color mixing. We will do some measurement of real illumination to find out the light quality and the spectral power distribution. We will also demonstrate colored shadows, one of Wolfgang Goethe's main demonstration. There will be a session related to testing color vision tests. And again, this is then related to universal design or display-oriented design. So I see some students already have made a decision and signed up. So please go ahead. So there will be a deadline, if I remember correctly, on Thursday 26. The goal is then that each and everybody has a group and signed up for a topic. So there is still some time remaining. And please include our Erasmus or exchange students as well. Any questions to that? Yes?
So it should be distributed well under the four topics, I guess, because everybody, there is just three kind of groups for the same topic.
Sure. It's kind of a procedure which we know as first comes, first serve principle, kind of. Okay, if somebody struggles with finding a group, then you know my email address or you know where I have my office, and then we have a talk or we find a solution together with the class representative. I did that for a couple of years now, and it has been sorted out each and every time. But I know it can be some kind of difficulties for some students to kind of make a decision. Okay, then going back to the today's program. So now we will have a talk or a presentation on the introduction to human color vision. And I just uploaded the lecture notes on that tab beforehand. I also would like to point out again the textbook. So that is the lecture is related to chapter 2 in the textbook. And I also added a Norwegian publication from Arne Valberg, named Fargesund fra sansing til vitenskap, where he also addresses the aspects of human color vision and perception, a kind of a summary or a compression of the today's topic. So I would like to ask you also to review that paper, which is definitely beneficial and a kind of an extension to the today's lecture notes. Okay. Yes. As said, the title of today's lecture is Introduction to Human Color Vision. And as we talked about last week, color is a kind of very important in interface design and color-related aspects of universal design. So therefore, it is a kind of essential to have a clear understanding about human color vision and human perception. So the lecture provides content about the mechanics of the eye, including the optical elements, the photosensitive neurons or photoreceptors, and the basic coding in the retina in the central visual pathway. And then talking about human color vision, it is also important to understand color appearance phenomena and two major theories about visual system, the three receptor theory and Hering's opponent theory. So that is the kind of the context of today's lecture. So we will have a look at why do we see colors? Why is that important? Then we will go through the different elements in the eye bowl. Then we will have a look at the retina, the retinal photoreceptors, and as just mentioned, we will talk about the two essential theories, the tri-receptor theory and the opponent color theory. And yeah, if time permits, we might have a look at lateral inhibition or retinal receptive field, which also helps to explain some of the visual phenomenon we almost on a daily basis are able to detect. So let's start off with a very simple question. So what is color? Do you have any opinion? Yes, please. reflection of light. Yes, yeah. Any other opinion? Yes, please. Yes. Okay. It goes into the same kind of direction as your classmate just pointed out. Yes. So this is, I would say this is more on the physical aspects. Are there any other opinion? Yes, please. Yeah, so interpretation of the signals hitting the sensor.
And also in the cultural context.
Yeah. Yeah. So probably what you're saying is a kind of in the direction of sensation, kind of, yeah. Yes. So then basically what is needed to be able to detect color? Kind of three elements, or perhaps even two elements. Yes, please.
Light.
Yes. What else?
An object.
Yes, and obviously the sensor. And of course, if you just have the sun, or if you have a light source, and we look at the light source, then there is no object needed. But this is the kind of the classical schematic explanation of how color can be detected. And what is important to mention here is that the second bullet point, that there are no colors in the electromagnetic spectrum, only waves. And with the waves, we do not know what kind of color we are talking about. So to support the previous slide, we can have a look at another schematic kind of flow, light flow, photon flow. So if we start with a light source, and then we have an object, and at the end we see, okay, the interpretation says, it is a reddish strawberry. So in that case, the strawberry is not red yet. Do you have an idea why in that case the object is not red yet? It's a kind of a philosophical question as well. Because at that stage, basically, there is no interpretation yet of the signal. So it is just something. But of course, if you look at the red strawberry, yeah, we will immediately say, this strawberry is red. Or if it is not mature yet, then it's probably green. So that was a kind of the question I asked in the last question last week. So if we switch off the light and we close the windows and it is dark in that room, and I ask the question: does all the colors kind of disappear, or are the colors still in the room? Of course, that is exactly the point, or the philosophical question. Yes, please.
When you dream, how can you explain this?
Very good question. I don't know. Or I have not thought about, but yeah. Okay. I mean, definitely, yeah, it's an interesting question. So if you dream, we are not exposed to any stimuli from outside. So there is no light source and there is no stimuli on the retina either. So then it has to be a kind of a sensation, a memory somehow, which takes place here in the visual cortex. Yeah, interesting question. Okay. So another question is the importance of color. Why do we see color? Any ideas? For pleasure or... Yeah, I mean, it's just the fantasy, a kind of limits the number of arguments. So definitely it's important for food detection so that we can distinguish between the ripe fruit and the non-ripe fruit. An important feature for survival, to protect, camouflage. So now, for instance, this black and white image just demonstrates schematically how difficult it would be to distinguish between a ripe and a apple, also a red apple or and a green apple. So it's definitely an excellent feature for food detection. Can be important to recognize and to discriminate objects from their surrounding, from their background. Can be important for emotion detection. Obviously, navigation, communication, and yeah, pleasure, art, and so on. And again, can you imagine or assume having a poor or no color vision at all? It would be rather difficult to navigate on that tube map where the different trains are leaving. So color is important because it helps us to discriminate objects from their surroundings. But how important is color actually? So if we split that image into the chromatic components, we can see that the chromatic information by itself provides relatively limited information. And by the way, chromatic, that means color, okay? And achromatic would then be black and white. Chromatic, achromatic. So that will be a term that will be repeated during the course quite frequently. So, however, if we have a look at the achromatic components, we can see how important the achromatic information is for all the fine details. And by the way, those who are doing some video and video compression, that is exactly kind of the principles to compress all the color information very very dense. And then the brightness or the black and white or the achromatic information then should be rather uncompressed. Again, coming back, how do we perceive these particular color? So this happens schematically in two different ways. In the first phase, a physical process takes the light reflected from the object into the retina. So then we have the light source. This object has certain reflectance properties. And we'll talk about reflectance and radiation next week. And then we will see that a reflection property. It's a kind of a static property for most of the objects, meaning that if I would measure the reflectance on that desk today and next week and in a half year, the reflectance properties would not significant change. But for instance, if I would measure food, like a piece of ham or a piece of bacon, and I would measure the bacon over a certain time, then we know that the reflectance properties are changing. And then together with the illumination combined with the reflectance, we get radiance, and the radiance is hitting the retina, and then we are stating, this is green. And the way we interpret the signal that this is green is also dependent on the type of light source. So if you use candlelight, and we know candlelight has a very kind of warmish, reddish, yellowish appearance, then we interpret the reflectance slightly different compared if you would use a kind of a bluish illumination. Okay, just to finish the two tasks. So as I said, in the first task, it's a kind of a physical process, as you two pointed out when I was asking, well, what is color? So then you were mentioning a kind of wavelengths, light, so that is in that area. And then consequently, the interpretation of the information is processed then in the brain, and resulting in a perception. Okay. And perhaps at that point, it is worth mentioning two important scientists who contributed a lot in understanding the human color vision. So firstly, I would like to mention Isaac Newton, who was an English physicist and mathematician, who is widely regarded as one of the most influential scientists of all time. So Newton, he viewed color as a physical phenomenon involving light striking objects and entering into our eyes. On the other hand, Johann Wolfgang Goethe, among others, reformulated the topic of color in an entirely new way. So he realizes that the sensation of color reaching our brain are also shaped by our perception. So by the mechanics of the human vision and by the way our brain processes the signal or the information. So therefore, according to Goethe, what we see of an object depends on the object's reflection properties, the lighting, and most important, our perception. So we can conclude that in a physical way explaining color, then the color is the product of light at certain wavelengths. On the other hand, color is the product in the observer's mind. And some time ago, I found this very nice proof for that. So if you stare at the cross in the center for a couple of seconds or a half a minute, So firstly, you have detected a kind of these magenta points, assigned in a circle, which are then bouncing around. But is there another color appearing on the way? Yes. How would you describe what kind of color do you see?
A greenish color.
A greenish color. Yes. So then my next question is, the statement is, you agree we would be able to measure with a sensor or with a spectrophotometer or a light meter, we would be able to measure the magenta stimuli. But would it be possible to measure also the green with such an instrument? Probably not. Exactly. So then this greenish color has to be processed or generated in our head or in the visual cortex. Good. So then we can determine that color vision is based on physical elements such as light, surface properties, spectral properties, physiology, so the study of the function of the organism or the eye, the sensitivity of the photoreceptors, and the perception or sensation based on the brain's interpretation of the signals. We also know that light is radiation in the form of electromagnetic wave that makes vision possible in the human eye. So visible light is distinguished from other forms of electromagnetic radiation by its ability, which is detectable by the retina of the human eye. So the electromagnetic radiation can be classified by its wavelengths and or frequency. And the wavelengths of visible spectrum starts from the short wavelengths of about 360, 70, 80 nanometers. And it goes all the way through about 730, 40, 50 nanometers. So in this area, we typically have what is called UV radiation, so ultraviolet energy. And then it starts from 750 up to 900, we call it for a near infrared, and then from 1000 further up, we call it for infrared. And basically, that tiny spectrum out from the huge electromagnetic spectrum is our visible spectrum. And that is also the visible spectrum for most of the kind of standard cameras. So your mobile devices probably detects a signal from that area to that area. The way the sensors are built, so most of the sensors, they have a UV filter attached. So without this filter, the camera would be able also to detect UV radiation. So in the lab, we have an old Canon PowerShot camera where we basically removed the UV cut filter so that we are able to detect this information. And then we added a kind of a visual range filter. So then we built a UV camera. And then together with some UV light, we can do experiments, for example, with testing sun cream or testing whether our glasses really have UV protection layers using ordinary camera. Or then talking about multispectral or hyperspectral camera. That is a camera which not only has three filters, also red, green, and blue filters, as your mobile camera or any ordinary DSLR camera. So then you have multiple areas to detect energy, and not only in the visible area, but also in the UV area and up to 2,000 nanometers. So this is not the kind of a commercial camera, but it's a kind of more research type of device which is used. I'm not sure whether I was mentioning that we captured one of Munch's Screak painting, and then using this type of technology and also getting information in the near-infrared and infrared region and then transposing that information into the visible area. And we were able to see through the different ink layers on the painting towards the canvas. And then it was possible to see that Munch has written some statements on the canvas before he was painting the Screak. Then another feature, obviously, with such a camera is to be able to detect the type of pigments a painter has used. So when it comes to restoration of a painting, for instance, then what is quite common to use is to scratch some small particles of the painting, also in a physical way, and then do some chemical analysis to be able to learn what kind of pigments the painter has used. But now, with this technology of multispectral or hyperspectral imaging, where you can detect information almost at any nanometer, and instead of having only three digits, also red, green, and blue, per pixel, you have a spectral power distribution of each and single pixel. So if in your camera, one pixel, so that is the smallest image element, then basically you have a red component, you have a green component, and you have a blue component. Only three different numbers. But with such a spectral camera, instead of three numbers, you have kind of a spectrum. So you have information from, let's say, 300 nanometer to 2,000 nanometer. Of course, only that is visible, but you can also statistically interpret non-visible information because it is kind of a power from the radiation. And then having this kind of fingerprint and having a huge, huge database of all kind of pigments. Also a database with, and you find exactly a match. Then you know exactly the pigment that, in that case, Munch has used to do the painting, without scratching any physical particle from the canvas. Okay, sorry, that was a kind of an extra excursion. So explaining kind of the powerful spectrum. Okay. but that is something we can reproduce in the lab in 2 weeks' time. So one bright sunny day, Newton darked his room and made a hole in his window shutter, and then allowing just one beam of sunlight to enter the room. And then he took a kind of a piece of glass, or I'm not sure whether he at that time was able to get these very nice glass prism. I assume he just used a glass part and placed that just into the beam. And then the result was a spectacular multicolored band of light, just like a rainbow. So this is then called a color spectrum, including seven hues in the order of red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. And then he understood that, okay, this is white light. Then we have a different medium which is able to a kind of refract the different wavelengths into different direction, ending with this rainbow. Then it should be also possible to do the inverse. So putting the prism upside down into the rainbow, then we are ending up again with white light. And then, of course, as seen in many other fields, a new theory or method or a claim then has been questioned by other scientists. And that was exactly what happened after Newton stated what color is about. So then approximately 150 years after Newton's statement, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe published his book on the theory of color back in 1810. Yeah, it says here. So the German original title is Zur Farbenlehre. So the content is mainly about Goethe's view on the nature of color and how color is perceived by humans. So the book covers detailed description of phenomena such as physiological colors, physical or prismatic colors, and chemical colors. So the essential difference between Goethe's theory of color and Newton's finding lies in the sense that basically, Newton said color is the product of light at a certain wavelength, and Goethe stated color is the product of the observer's mind. I also added a link from a Danish film producer, Light, Darkness, and Color. I don't remember. This is probably done in the 90s. So it's about sensation, perception, visual phenomena based on Goethe's theory of colors. So it's kind of it's a very nice, soft movie explaining different type of visual phenomena. So I highly recommend to have a look at the link. Okay, it's 3 minutes to 11 before we dig into the mechanics of vision. I propose to have a break. I propose we regather again at 10 past 11. Okay. Any questions so far? Comments? Okay. So we regather at 10 past 11.
I wasn't here at the first lecture, so could you please tell me what was about assignments? Are we going to get grade? Does it affect the exam grade?
Okay. So you have not been here last time, or,
no.
Or you were here last time?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't.
Okay. So the assignment is about. So have you had a look at the Blackboard?
Yeah.
So you have seen the introduction.
Presentation, yeah.
So what to do and what this is about?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So basically. As it is stated.
The only thing I didn't understand is, are we going to get grades? Or is
okay.
A bestow?
It's pass fail.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it does. So there is no grade and it doesn't affect
no
on
grade.
The...
But there is a but.
Yeah, okay.
So in terms of the quality level, it is expected to provide a good performance. A good performance is equal to a C. So I was stating that very clearly to avoid any kind of misunderstanding that experienced previously, you know, that students interpret the pass-fail. Okay, I just need a kind of on the E level, then this is pass,
yeah.
Which is not. So you have to perform. You know, if I grade or if I assess your work or the group work, then I use these criteria to assess. And then, as it says here, the written report is assessed by us, or by me, and needs to be approved. The performance to get the report approved needs to correspond to a C level.
So it means that it's supposed to be as good as
C,
but it's...
exactly.
Yeah, okay, now I get it.
Just to make this clear, you know, so that people kind of... not try just to rush, you know, and to submit something and with the idea that this is probably a pass, this is on the E level. So now it has to be a good work where you by yourself can be satisfied.
Okay.
And that is kind of, it's a good performance, it's a C.
I see.
But otherwise, it's just the oral exam, which then it's 100%.
Okay, yeah, now I
agree. Okay,
thank you so much.
Good, you're all welcome. Oh, yeah.
address on the board for the people to contact me about the workshop.
Thank you.
Somebody wants the PDF of the book, of course, for academic purposes, educational purposes. Please consume me. This is the email address.
Thank you.
I am searching a group when I'm about it. I want to do the lightning stuff, so if somebody wants to do the lightning measurement stuff and still is in need of a group member, also contact me, please. Thank you.
Okay. So name and email from Anne-Christine is also on Blackboard. Okay.
Oh, I wrote it wrong. Sorry.
But is this correct on Blackboard?
It's not. Ah, yes, there it is. So you have it. Stream reference.
Okay. Right. Good.
That's wrong, by the way. So it's going to do the Blackboard thing.
Okay. Good. Let's move on. Mechanics of vision. Okay. When we schematically compare the eye with a camera, the focus is mostly on the optical structure. From this figure, we can clearly see that the lens of a camera and the lens of our eye has some similar function. So if that is the lens. In addition, aperture has almost the same function in both the eye and the camera. The aperture, that is the opening which let photons into the eyeball, or lets photons onto the CCD or CMOS. So that then acts as a kind of a sensor. So the retina is the location of photosensitive cells, as I just said, similar to what we have in couplet charge devices or CCD or complementary metal oxide semiconductor CMOS. So these are the most two common sensors for film cameras. So similar to photographic film, photomechanical reaction happens when the light incidents onto the eye. But be aware of this is very schematically, but it's possible to kind of compare on a very simplified level. Okay, then let's have a look at the structure of the eye. So the sagittal plane means a vertical plane dividing a body into a right and a half way. That is what a sagittal horizontal section means. And in that case, it's of an eye. So basically, entire eyeball is just divided into two pieces. That is what sagittal horizontal section means. So the eyeball has basically a shape of a bullet with a diameter of approximately 2.5 centimeters. And the largest part is filled with a very clear, colorless fluid that fills the space between the lens and the retina. And then the cornea is the very first refraction surface. So that is the cornea, which is transparent for UV light all the way down to approximately 290 non-visible nanometers. But the cornea has a very great power of more than what is called 40 diopters, which means, also diopters is the reciprocal, in that case, 1 divided by 40 meter, which is then equal to 2.5 centimeters. So diopter is the reciprocal unit of meters. So in that case, 40 diopters, also 40 divided by 1 divided by 40 meters is equal to 2.5 centimeters. Maybe important to know is the fact that irregularities in the cornea will have a major consequence for the quality of the retinal image. So it's not only the distortion of the lens or some artifacts of the lens which has a kind of an impact on the image. It is basically the very first layer, this cornea, which is kind of very, very important. And also we know that the cornea has fine nerve fibers and is very sensitive to touch. And also we know that from a very strong UV exposure radiation that can cause inflammation on the cornea, so-called snow blindness, kind of. Okay, so we move on. Pupil or aperture is an opening in the center of the iris of the eye. So that is the opening there. So it regulates basically the amount of light entering the eye or hits the retina. So the pupil is black in color because the light is absorbed by tissues inside the eye. So in bright light, the pupil has a diameter of approximately 2 millimeters. And in a semi-darkness, the size can be up to an opening of 8 millimeters. And as we know, we do have a round aperture or a pupil, whereas other species might have an oval or even a split-shaped pupil. Yes?
Does the diameter adjust according to the light source we're looking at or according to the entire environment?
So it is adjusting according to the brightness as such. So so if we are locked up in a kind of a completely dark room, then of course after a couple of minutes, then probably the pupil is very, very open because it tries to navigate and to suck some photons to get on the retina. Having said that, black room and locked up just came to my mind. We half an hour ago we stated we need a light source to see color, but also we know if there is no light at all, and we have tested that down in the color lab in the bunker room where there is no light at all. But then we see a kind of a flickering, you know, going on. So there is some high light flickering. And of course, that is a kind of noise, even though there is no photons in the room, or almost no photons. So we could say, okay, there is not really light necessary to be able to detect something. So that was also degradation. So coming back to your question, there is also a kind of an adaptation mechanism we know. So for instance, going from daylight into a dark room, or typically in a cinema, it takes much longer time to the darkness, or to the dim light of the cinema. But when we leave the cinema and immediately we get into the sunlight, of course, then it is a lot of light. But then within 10 seconds, perhaps, we have already adapted. And that means probably also then the aperture has decreased very rapidly from a certain size to perhaps two millimeters. Then, of course, it's also the type of relationship which we will see, you know, to the different photoreceptors. So there are mainly two photoreceptors we will talk about, the rods and the cones. And the rods are actually much, much more sensitive than the cones, which are kind of responsible for our color vision. And it's really amazing the range of adaptation our sensor or the eye can produce, compared to nowadays people talk about HDR imaging, also high dynamic range images. We talk about HDR displays, where the display goes up to 1,000 or 2,000 candelas. So this monitor, or probably your displays, if we would measure, probably 160, 140 candela per square meters, which is equal to luminance or brightness. And then with HDR, the range from black to the white is much higher. But still, compared to our eye and adaptation, this is much wider. Yes. Okay. Yes. So then, this is a kind of a schematic view of the eye. So the iris is the gray, green, brown area. So that is basically the iris. Then all the structures visible are the pupil in the center. So that is the pupil. Then we have the sclera, which is the surrounding, kind of this white. And then the cornea is also pictured, but is not visible because it's transparent. The lens, unlike ordinary glass lenses, the eye's lens is very flexible in its curvature and thickness. So an automatic muscle press adjusts then the lens, so that we always get the best, sharpest possible image, regardless of the distance to the object we are looking at. So in camera, this is arranged by varying the distance between the lens and the film or the CCD, which is needed. So in the eye, it is the lens that changes the shape, so that the light rays are reflected towards the retinal focus at the back of the eye. And connected to this kind of flexible lens in the eye, it is what is called the accommodation range as a function of age. So I have just mentioned the eye normally has a certain ability to regulate the curvature of the lens, and those sharpening then the image on the retina. So basically, what I try to say is if there is an infinite view, if that is the eye, and that is the lens, so then the lens doesn't have a strong curvature on a very long distance, and that is a kind of the default setting. But if I read the display and I need to get sharp letters, then the lens has then this kind of, or it looks like that. So in other words, this is for the sharpening to the infinite distance. And if we have a look at the near hold, then the curvature has to be different. And that is done with the aid or the muscle pressure. So the muscle is pressuring then the lens more together to get this shape. And we know that over time, the ability to adapt the refraction is reducing. So both the lens as such becomes more stiff, and the muscle pressure is reducing. And that means that with 40, 50, you need some correction on your glasses to be able to get a short image on a short hold. And that is what is called accommodation range. So basically, that is the function. So that is the age of years. So probably most of you are in that area where you have a near point of, so this is a half a meter. So for you guys, probably it's very easy to sharpen on 10 centimeters close hold. But then if you reach probably around 40 or even further up, then it is not possible anymore to get a sharpened image on that close hold. Then you need some compensation using different glasses. So then we move on to the retina. So the retina is considered as part of the central nervous system, and it is the part of the eye that captures the visual impression or provides or reads an image we see. So it lies like a backdrop inside the eye, and the retina is covered by light-sensitive cells called photoreceptors, and there are two types of such photocells, as I just mentioned, the rods and the cones. So the cones helps to perceive colors and result sharp vision, while the rods provide kind of a black and white vision and a vision in the dark. And each of the eyeballs contains approximately 100 million rods, and only 6 million cones. So there is a huge difference in terms of the numbers of photoreceptors for rods and cones. And obviously, the rods got their shape, got their name from their shape, which is long and cylindrical, while the cones are shorter and more cone shaped. So, in the retina, the enormous amount of information that the photoreceptors receive is interpreted and organized by the cells, reacting to differences in brightness. So on top, so that image shows you that area. So if we pick an area, then we have the kind of these different layers of photoreceptors, and that is a kind of a corresponding image. So the photoreceptors are in the deepest layer of the retina. So these are the cones, and these are the rods. And as you can see, the number of rods is much higher compared to the number of cones. And what is also quite interesting to see is that the light is entering here, and then the light or the photons needs to go through a huge network or layers of different cells until they reach the photoreceptors. I have to admit, I don't remember the reason why it is kind of this way and not the opposite. So we might think that it is more obvious if the photoreceptors would be at the start, if the photons enters the retina. But the reality is that the photons needs to go through very dense layers of cells until they reach the final photoreceptors. So when light falls on the photoreceptors, it creates a photomechanical reaction in the two photoreceptors. Then the reaction then continues to the horizontal cells, to the bipolar cells, to the amacrine cells, and then finally to the retinal ganglion cells, before the ganglion cells leave the eyeball, and then it continues to the brain and to the area which is called the visual cortex. So now, if you have a look again at this schematic image, and we talk about these different cell layers, so then we can see that the idea of the horizontal cells, so the horizontal cells are typically these cells. And these cells, they receive signal information from various receptors. So it is only in the fovea, and we will get to the fovea, where we have a one-to-one relationship between a photoreceptor and the ganglion cell. Whereas in the periphery, outside the fovea, there are multiple photoreceptors which contribute to a horizontal cells. Then we have the bipolar cells, which is the connection between the horizontal and the amacrine cells. Also connecting again more information until the information is leaving that eyeball. We won't go into details, but the main message is that it happens a lot of, I would say, schematically speaking, image processing. And the image processing is all about contrast. I think I was mentioning the term contrast last time. It's that is very, very important. So therefore, the idea of having multiple inputs into the horizontal cells from multiple photoreceptors is exactly to calculate differences from minimum to maximum. And that is what contrast is about. Okay, to sum up the two receptors, so in terms of the rods, we said that they are much more sensitive in lower level of illumination. They generate an achromatic signal or a response, highly sensitive, even able to react on a single photon. And those who have experience being in wintertime out in the woods, fully adapted, it is really amazing the way we are still able to navigate, even though there is hardly no light. And of course, most of the people, then they do some exercise and they use torches and light. And then, of course, this mechanism is gone. But otherwise, it's really amazing how sensitive the rods are. Even though there is hardly no light and we are fully adapted, it is possible still to navigate. I think it's fascinating. number of sensors, 100 to just 5 million. It gives low acuity, also sharpening, versus the sharp image is related to cone vision and not to rod vision. So also we know that if you are out in the woods and there is not much light, the image is not that sharp either. So that is a kind of the trade-off. It's not that sharp, but still we are able to distinguish between different small shades. Then the cones, color vision responsible, less sensitive than the rods. And then very important, there is not only one type of cone. So we do have three types of cones. They are names as L, M, and S. And L, M, S stands for long wavelengths sensitive, medium wavelengths sensitive, and S is short. So academic speaking, we should talk about LMS. I mean, in popular science, it is very common that we use red, green, and blue. So that we say we are sensitive to red, green, and blue. But then again, if you look at the workflow, so that is happening in the eye. And in the eye, we do not know yet what kind of color it is. It is then later on the brain which tells us this is blue or this is brown or this is blue or this is gray. So therefore, more appropriate is to use LMS, even though red and green would be acceptable as well. Also, another aspect is the distribution. So it's not the case either that we have equal number of, I'm talking about now filters or red filters. It's not 50 red filters and 50 blue filters and 50 green filters. So the relationship is 40L, also red. So the most sensors is related to red. Then divided by 20 is only half is green. And then only a very small amount of short wavelengths, sensitive or blue cones. As I mentioned already, so in terms of the light absorptions, the mechanism of the eye's response to light is photochemical and is very similar to photography in classical camera using kind of sensitive film. So a photoreceptor's response to light by absorbing a light photon or a light quanta in its photopigment is called excitation. And by converting this event to an electrical potential difference or brightness difference. So in other words, when light hits a molecule in a photoreceptor, it bleaches and causing an electrical activation that leads to a visual sensation. And then while in the bleached stage, so if the photoreceptor is exposed to lighting, it is then again unresponsive to light because it is already excited and is not able to detect or to gather more photons. So the pigment molecule of rhodopsin is rhodopsin. It's also called visual purple, consisting of an opsin. An opsin is a kind of a protein. And the retinol, whereas in the LM and S cones type, there is another photopigment consisting of a different opsin, also a protein bound to a retinol or vitamin A. Okay, then again, the differentiation between rod and cone response. So I would like to introduce three new terms. Photopic vision. That is the scientific term for human color vision under normal lighting conditions during the day. So photopic vision is a kind of in the range of probably 3-4 candela per square meters. So the human eye uses then the three type of cones to sense light. If I say 3-4 candela per square meter, so once again, probably on your display, we talk about 120, 140, 150 candela per square meters or luminance or brightness. I would say in here, this is more than 5 candela. So in that room, probably this is a rather typical photopic vision environment. And of course, if we leave the room and outside now in daytime, this is purely photopic vision. But of course, if I then would reduce the lighting and I would switch off the projector, then it would be something called mesopic vision. Because then the rods will also become active, okay? So if it goes below a certain degree of brightness or luminance, then we have both the rods, both the cones and the rods. And then in the night, during the night, if there is no light at all or just the moon, then it is probably pure scutopic vision. So scutopic vision is purely rod vision. Footopic vision is cone vision. And in an environment in between, that is called for mesopic vision. So this is just another example of luminance and visual mode at various conditions. So I was talking about candela per square meters. So above about 4 or 3, we talk about mesopic, and then really threshold of vision then is at very, very few light quanta. Okay, so the next couple of slides, I will introduce a couple of such graphs indicating the what is called the sensitivity of the photoreceptors. So again, related to photopic vision, also cone vision, the luminous efficiency function, difficult term, luminous efficiency function or photopic luminosity function describes the average spectral sensitivity of the human perception of brightness. So in other words, this function, or that means that for a given wavelength of electromagnetic radiation, it is the relative ability to induce sensation of light. So again, this shows 400 nanometers to 700 nanometers, and this is the sensitivity function of the cones, okay, which are responsible for color vision. And then it shows all these three combined together. The best sensitivity is at approximately 555 nanometer, kind of greenish area. And then we are less sensitive at the bluish, and perhaps a little bit less sensitive when it comes to the long wavelength. But there's always a but. if we talk about the sensitivity of the rods, then that is slightly different. So again, it's a kind of a complicated graph, but we just talked about the photopic sensitivity function, that is the red one, at peak 555 nanometer. And if you have a look at the scutopic, also the rod function only, then we see it is a slightly shift. It's approximately 50 nanometer shift between day vision and night vision. It's not exactly the same. So this is basically these two functions. So the scutopic vision is called V lambda, and V lambda, and then V prime lambda. That is for the scutopic vision. So there is a shift. And quite interesting, to these two sensitivity functions, there is an interesting visual phenomenon attached. Probably you have experienced that yourself. So the phenomenon is about, in summertime, if we go down to the park in Gjøvik, So there are some flowers, what is it called, tulipans, red tulipans and blue tulipans. If we go there in daytime, and I would ask you, which of the two tulipans are brightest? Is it the blue tulipans or is it the red tulipans? Then it's probably the majority would point to the red flowers. The red flowers, they look slightly brighter than the blue ones in daytime. Now we are going back to the same spot in the night where there is almost no light and there is no cone vision. It's only rod vision. So everything is kind of black and white and a little bit unsharp. Then you would be able to distinguish between some really pitch black flowers and some grayish flowers. Meaning that in the daytime, the bluish would be a kind of grayish in the night. And the red flower in the daytime would be pitch black at night. And that is due to the shift of the sensitivity from cone vision, also photopic vision, to scotopic vision. I'm not sure whether maybe I ask too much if I will ask the question if you have experienced that or not. So it's so now I've talked about this for quite some time, but still the other day I have a very old red Coca-Cola red jacket, and then we have a kind of a blue leash for the dog. And I went into the woods at night, and the blue leash I had around my arm on the red jacket. And then after half an hour or an hour being in the woods, it was really amazing how this blue, dark blue leash was appearing almost light gray, whereas then the red jacket, it was pitch black. It was a huge, huge contrast. And that is Purkinje shift. Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Fovea, I was mentioning fovea, that is the small pitch in the retina at the back of the eye, at the back is about only 1.5 millimeters. That is the pitch there. It is also called a yellow spot. And important, it contains cones only. So it's cones only in there. There's no rods. And it is also the location at the retina where vision is most acute, also most sharp. And then finally, that is the area where the optic nerves leaves the eyeball. So there are no photoreceptors at all. That is just a way for you to find the blind spot. Now I've forgotten some paper copies with that. I don't know whether this is possible from this distance. So my point is, if you have a piece of paper, then you can just make a cross and the bullet. And then the point is, you can find your own blind spot by closing, then the left eye, and you steer at the cross with the right eye, okay? And then you move it forward and back. And then at a certain distance, there is then the spot where there is no bullet detectable. And that means that you have reached exactly the distance where this black dot is above the optic nerve or the blind spot. I'm not sure whether this is because you need to move and anyway, it's just for demonstration purposes. So coming back to the density distribution in the fovea, so that again is the fovea spot with the angles from away from the fovea. So we have the blue line is indicating the density of the cones, also for color vision. And we see that in the periphery, there's not so many cones. But as more we go towards the retina, then the number of cones is increasing. And then again, there is less density of the cones on the periphery. Regarding the rods, it's almost the opposite. So the red dashed line is indicating the density of the rods, and we see, yeah, there are quite many rods outside in the periphery, and when it comes to the fovea, there's almost no rods, cones only. And again, that is related to the relationship we talked about previously. So this is just a schematic illustration indicating the relationship between 40-20-1, also the most red cones or L cones, and then 20 green cones, and just a few S cones. Then that graph shows the photoreceptors, and this is called a normalized cone absorption curve or sensitivity curve. And the normalization refers to a process that makes something more or less regular. And we see now this is the normalized absorbance, and we see that all of them are on top of 100. And that is what is called, we normalize different data up on the same level. That is one way of visualizing data, to normalize the data, but it doesn't mean that this is the reality. It's just a way of presenting data. And very often, these type of graph you find in different textbooks and so on. So this presentation is in some respects misleading because it distorts the functional relationship between light wavelengths, cone sensitivity, and cone perception. The comparison with the photopigment absorption curves both identifies three obvious differences between the sharp peak and the sensitivity of the photopigments and cone function. So once again, it is rather similar to the previous one where all the cones are up to 100. It is a way of visualizing the data, and it gives a kind of an idea that the L and M cones are rather close. Again, some people discuss this is due to food detection, whereas then the S cone is kind of more independent compared to the L and M. Then you might find these type of graph. So as I said, a problem with the linear normalized cone fundamentals is that they emphasize the overall peak, also the peak shape of the curves. As a result, they do not adequately display the tails or the extreme low curves. So a better solution is then to present the normalized curves, not linear, but on a logarithmic curve. So this is a logarithmic scale which means that if I go from there to there and from 3 to 4, it is always the double. It's not the linear distance, which is the same. It is the double. So this is also a way of illustrating the cone sensitivity. So this is probably the most accurate picture of the proportional responses probability of the three cones classes. We can highlight a couple of insights. So we see that the L and M cones produce nearly all the information acquired by the retina. First of all, if we have a look, so the cone sensitivity does not go up to 1. But if we add 0.65 plus 0.3 plus 0.05 equal to 100. Okay? So if we add these three curves, then we go up to 200. But this is probably the most accurate indicating how sensitive LMS is about. And then we can really see the difference, how little sensitive the S cones are compared to the M and L. And of course, this we know in design. So using such a design, it's probably not appropriate. It's a kind of foo-foo to use such a design. So now we could also invert that. I do not have... I wanted to do that. is white background and yellow typesetting. Okay, so this is also not appropriate, and this is related to exactly that relationship. Okay, it's 12 o'clock, yes. To sum up, to summarize the previous slides, rod vision is achromatic, resulting in poor details and no color detection. On the other hand, the sensitivity of the rod receptors is very high. So this is a kind of summing up the previous slides. And this is a schematic visualization of the retinal image. So firstly, we can see the image is upside down. So probably some of you have kind of explored camera obscura, or if you would dig a hole in the wall and we would have a canvas, and then the image from outside and would be upside down on the canvas. Then only the central area of the retina at the fovea has a high spatial resolution and is sensitive to color. So probably that is the fovea area. The periphery of the retina has low resolution and can mostly detect lightness differences only. And lastly, the blind spot does not contain any photoreceptors at all. And to finish up today's talk is what we started off with, some kind of philosophical thoughts. So this is again from the book from Arne Wahlberg. So he says, when it gets dark, our qualitative experience of color disappears. But once the light is turned on, we perceive colors and contrast. So then the question is, does that imply that colors never disappeared? Or does it just mean that there is too little light that the cones can respond to the color, which is always there? Also, the color is always there. Or isn't color a physical element that is always present. Okay, by that I close the session. I have a couple of slides remaining, but these couple of slides, they fit excellent into the talk in 2 weeks, which is about human color vision phenomena, when we talk about simultaneous contrast, after-image effect, color shadows, color constancy. Then I will introduce the tri-receptor Helmholtz theory and the hearing opponent theory. Okay, chat about coursework, group, constellation, and the topic, and provide your names into the spreadsheet. Okay, we talk next week.